From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, what's going on with Detroit's most talked about businessman, Dan Gilbert? He disappeared from the public eye for the better part of a year after suffering a stroke. Until now.
People have put a lot of stock in Dan Gilbert, and their future rests with Dan Gilbert.
Cranes Detroit spoke with Gilbert recently. We'll talk about his unique position in the economic firmament. Also, gauging the flow of special interest group spending in this election year. We'll look at one super PAC weighing in on Senator Gary Peters' challenger.
And the fact that it's already gotten $800,000 from members of the DeVos family is a signal of how much activity this group might be undertaking this year.
And collecting within the community, African-American art from a buyer's perspective.
Art changes your life, and you don't know that it has. You know, so you don't know that you've been living in this void with nothing on your wall.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On the show today, we're going to check in with that Michigan family stuck at sea because of the new coronavirus outbreak. Turns out a few days can make a pretty big difference. But first, when Quicken Loans emperor Dan Gilbert started seeing double and was rushed to the hospital last spring, it was like a bomb had gone off in Detroit's business community. Months of silence followed from Gilbert and those closest to him. A lot of people had 1,000 questions. What was going on with Dan Gilbert? Who was running his companies? And what might happen if suddenly he weren't there? We got some answers to those questions over the weekend as Dan Gilbert gave an exclusive interview to Crane's Detroit Business ahead of Crane's Newsmaker of the Year event. Here's Gilbert telling Crane's about his experience with stroke.
If you have a stroke when you're done, here's the problem with it. Everything is hard, everything. Like, you wake up, getting out of bed is hard, going to the bathroom is hard, sitting down, eating at a table is hard. You name it, you don't get a break. You're like trapped in your own body.
Here with us now is Chad Livengood, senior editor at Cranes, who was part of the exclusive interview. Chad, good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
So Dan Gilbert is somewhat notorious for having his hands on many parts of his business. We might say all facets of Quicken Loans and its accompanying ventures. For somebody like that, I imagine being incapacitated is not a small thing. What impression did you get of how he reacted to the experience?
Yeah, in the months before he had this stroke, Dan was doing a podcast called Speed of the Game that was literally kind of about his life, you know, sort of keeping up with the speed of the game of business, of the game of sports. I mean, this is a guy who, jetted around the country, went back and forth between Detroit and Cleveland all the time to go watch his Cavaliers basketball team play. He has multiple different types of business interests. He owns 100 properties in downtown Detroit as part of that property buying spree he made in the past decade after he moved Quicken Loans to Detroit and built up a 17,000 employee workforce. All of that kind of came screeching to a halt when Dan Gilbert suffered this stroke over Memorial Day weekend.
He is also maybe not very well known for being an emotional guy about his legacy and having a level of introspection. You've covered him for a while now. Do you think that that might change as a result of his experience?
I certainly sense that he has changed in that he's been humbled by this experience. I mean, this was a near-death stroke. He was paralyzed in the left side of his body. He said that for the first couple of days afterwards, he was dead weight. He couldn't move at all. He has regained his ability to stand, but he still is struggling with his left arm and use of those motor skills. So he talked about just like in that clip, about how everything is harder to do now. And he has a greater appreciation for healthcare and healthcare workers. He also has a greater appreciation for what insurance doesn't cover. Of course, this is a man who Forbes says is worth $7 billion. So he can buy as much medical care and rehab that he wants. Certainly more than you and I could. So I think he's seen a different side of life that he hadn't seen outside of, being this mortgage mogul.
How would you say he's doing? I mean, would you have known that he'd had a stroke?
Yes, certainly. He's lost a lot of body mass and weight. I mean, this is a man who's a shorter man to begin with, but he had always kind of had a barrel chest and was sort of known to talk about his weightlifting. And even that day that he had this stroke, he actually initially attributed some of his symptoms of his arms shaking to the weightlifting and routine he was doing with a trainer earlier that day.
Just thinking it was exhaustion.
Exactly. And,
yeah.
And he also thought that he was seeing double because he was up on this patio overlooking Hart Plaza, downtown Detroit, and there was this electronic music festival, this light show that was going on across the street at Hart Plaza, and he thought that maybe that had something to do with it. He was he had a group of friends over that night, and in attendance that night among his group of friends was Dr. Stephen Adamczak, who was an emergency room physician. He looked over Gilbert and noticed he had all the symptoms of a stroke, that his face was drooping, his speech was slurred, that he was having arm pain and weakness. And so he advised him to go to a hospital.
Well, what's the situation right now? Is Stan Gilbert expecting to make a full recovery?
Not exactly sure. You never know with these kind of things. It's been well over 8 months since this stroke. He's still getting PT and OT every day in his home in Franklin in suburban Detroit. But he's also starting to go into work once or twice a week now. He has a service dog, a black lab named Cowboy, who I think is going to become a star in Detroit in the ensuing months here. But he needs assistance in all different ways now. So it remains to be seen. You know, he's now trying to refocus on some of his business interests. He's in the midst of trying to build the first skyscraper in Detroit in the 21st century. And that project at the Hudson's department store building site has been scaled back. He initially was going to build a 900-foot building. Now it's probably going to be less than 727 feet, which is the height of the Renaissance Center Marriott Hotel.
And remind us, did those plans change after he suffered this physical setback or before?
They made them public that they were scaling back the project after.
Dan Gilbert is 57 years old. I mean, a stroke is nothing to take lightly, but at the same time, he's a relatively young man. Did you get a sense that his ambitions have changed?
It does seem that, you know, he's really kind of trying to zero in on just getting his body back in working order. You know, he's got a family of four children that he's focused on as well, and he's seemingly not trying to get into other ventures. So we'll see if he's going to actually scale back his business interests. I mean, this is a man who owns like over 100 companies or some share in 100 companies and an NBA basketball team. So he already has hands in a lot of pots.
When someone who's has that level of importance in the community has a stroke, it sends shockwaves through the entire downtown business community with ripple effects throughout the business and political elite all over Michigan. Do you think that this entire situation, how it's played out, has told us anything about Dan Gilbert's economic and development impact in Detroit?
Yeah, people have put a lot of stock in Dan Gilbert, and their future is rest with Dan Gilbert. I mean, he is doing all these different renovation of buildings and building new buildings. Think about all the construction companies that basically have got their economic fortune sort of tied to his wagon. And then there's other businesses that have moved to Detroit. They've made investment decisions. They're bringing employees or hiring based on these investments that Gilbert is putting into the city.
People see cranes up around town, they start to think about their own plans differently.
Exactly, yeah. It definitely has spurred a lot of momentum in the recent years, and Gilbert has been just very influential in getting people to come his way when he wants people to come his way. And that's made him both a force within the city from an economic development standpoint and also within the state from the political standpoint. I mean, just days prior to this stroke, Dan Gilbert and his lobbyists engineered a massive change in the auto insurance no-fault law at the legislature. And he was texting the governor congratulations for doing this that day before he came down with these symptoms of stroke that night. So that also illustrates both the fact that Dan Gilbert has become a very big political force in this state, but also it illustrates just how precious life can be and how quickly life can change.
As we've mentioned, this man basically went off the radar when he had the stroke. I mean, it was absolute silence. Do you think that there's something that we learned about just his position as being such a large outsized figure in the firmament of the Detroit business community, and maybe what the rest of the balance of power looks like in the city?
Yeah, when this happened Saturday, Sunday, Memorial Day weekend, and then the entire business community of Detroit went to Mackinac Island the next 2 days later for the Detroit Regional Chamber's annual conference up there. I mean, there was just an air of uncertainty about what is going to happen if Dan Gilbert doesn't make it, or what is going to happen if he doesn't come back the way he was and have the same presence. And he may still not have the same full force that he had before. But like I said before, people have kind of staked their futures on this guy. Politicians have kind of staked their public policy on this guy. I mean, he single-handedly got former Governor Rick Snyder and the Republican legislature to put down their guard against tax incentives and pass a whole new tax incentive so he could build skyscrapers in Detroit through a tax capture transformational brownfield incentive. And that, I mean, he just has been able to move mountains in ways that others have not. So, you know, there may be a void to fill there in the future.
Do you mind saying how you managed to get the time with him?
I spent a lot of months trying to talk to his people about having an interview about what happened, being sensitive to the issues, just to how personal this was of a journey for him. And then, you know, I've been covering politics and business in Detroit for many years, and so I just have, you know, a lot of some rapport with some of those people. And I've written a lot about his own businesses as well along the way.
Maybe it doesn't hurt that he's going to be at the Newsmakers of the Year lunch coming up this Friday.
Doesn't hurt. He is coming to speak at the MGM Grand on Friday in what will be his first real public speech. He's made just very few appearances at little events over the last few months, but has not spoken out until now.
Well, Chad, thanks for telling us about how this went down, and we appreciate your time today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Chad Livengood is our guest, senior editor at Crain's Detroit. He spoke with Dan Gilbert for a story that was published over the weekend. Dan Gilbert will make that speech at the Crain's Newsmakers of the Year lunch this Friday. You can find a link to Chad's article if you go find our Twitter account. We're at Stateside Radio. Coming up, two art collectors talk about their love of African American art.
Just buy what you like and just enjoy it. Your investment is having the experience of having it in your life, and it changes your life.
That's next on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. For a long time, African American artists did not get much recognition in the world of fine art, galleries and museums alike. But that has not stopped art lovers from building impressive collections of work by Black painters, Black sculptors, and others. Today, we invited a couple of collectors to talk about their love of African American art and how the business of buying and selling has changed over the past couple of decades. George Anamdi is founder and owner of the Anamdi Center for Contemporary Art in Detroit. For several decades, it's been a go-to destination to see art and meet Black artists. Also with us today is Reverend Anthony Artis, a minister and art collector. He lives in Flint. Works belonging to his family are on view now at the Flint Institute of Arts in an exhibition called Wonderfully Made. Welcome to Stateside, both of you.
Well, happy to be here.
Hey, it's an honor to be here. Thank you.
Could we start out, Anthony? I just wanted to ask you about the first work that you bought.
Yeah, the first piece my family ever bought that had some kind of investment value, that was a real piece of quality art, was a 1904 circa etching by Henry Oswald Tanner, entitled "The Disciples See Christ Walking on the Water." And
for those who don't know, he was really the first African-American painter to really gain recognition, wasn't he?
Actually, internationally, there was a couple other African-American artists that ended up leaving America, going to Paris, France, and I had a chance to be judged more so on their talent. But Tanner, what really touches my heart is the fact that he focused a lot on religious themes. His father was Benjamin Tanner, who was a bishop in the AME church, and his father was trying to get his son to walk in his footsteps, hoping to be a preacher or pastor. And he said, "Dad, you know, you use your pulpit to preach." He said, "I'll use my brush."
There are a number of works in the collection that are centered around themes of faith. Obviously, this one fit right in with your interests in a lot of ways and works on a lot of different levels. You and your wife, Davida, now have a collection that also includes works by Jacob Lawrence, you know, one of the masters, and contemporary artists, cutting-edge people like Yehinde Wiley. At what point did this become more than a collection of works that you liked and that inspired you?
Well, my big motivation, arts didn't really intercept my life until I was in my mid-40s. And at the time, I was working at the Ruth Mott Foundation in Flint and exposed to Marianne Mott's Mott Warsh collection. You know, being able to choose our works from her collection to hang in our office, it was a perk. But at the time, I knew nothing about art. I wasn't really reared in it. My last name is Artist, so I think God has a sense of humor. But I didn't appreciate it. One day, I made a flippant comment to my curator colleague, and I said, "Whoever this Jacob Lawrence guy is," I said, "my son can, you know, draw better than him, and he's in the third and seventh grade." And she says, "Really?" So the piece we were looking at was entitled "Saint Mark." She said, "Anthony, here's what I want you to do. I want you to research the piece, research the artist and the subject matter. Let's just have a conversation." That piece, it had a picture of a black man, real dark color, a unique uniform. And after I began to research it, went home, Googled it, I realized that piece was General Toussaint Louverture, who led a place called Little Hispaniola or Little Spain or Haiti.
That we know now as the architect of the Haitian Revolution.
Exactly. And he led a group of people who were migrants or sharecroppers or farmers to fight for their liberation against the Spanish army and the French army simultaneously. And they won their freedom. You know, usually you always read about a group of blacks that rise and they all get slaughtered. You know, Nat Turner and stuff like that. You know, they all get massacred and captured. But in this case, they won their freedom. And this is against Napoleon Bonaparte and the Spanish army as well. And I was floored. And at that point, then I began to research Jacob Lawrence, and I realized he was one of the most prominent African-American artists at all time. And I was ashamed. I was ashamed that I didn't know about these people. And so when I went to work on Monday, you know, I ate a big chunk of humble pie. And the curator, she says, "Anthony, listen," she said, "by the way, these pieces in your office are more than your salary." And at that point, you know, being an undergrad in accounting, you know, the financial piece as well as the historical piece and the beauty of it, it just really, that's when I got bit hard by the art bug.
Yeah. George Anamdi?
Yes.
When you first opened your gallery in 1981, what was the art scene in Detroit like?
The art scene in Detroit in 81, it was very unique. It was active art scene, but we didn't have galleries per se. And I really started the gallery. I was trained, I have a degree in psychology from the University of Michigan here, and I thought of the arts being something for our community's mental health.
And we were just coming out of the 70s, you know, just an explosive period of black creativity in Detroit.
Exactly. We had a lot, but we didn't have galleries. But we did our first exhibition in 1981. It was all abstract art, and all the artists there were from New York. And that was a great exhibition. I didn't know how great it was until other people started telling me, and then it got written up as the best group exhibition of the season. And to have that on your first exhibition was huge.
How did you talk to people about collecting when you first started out?
Well, I started buying art when I was 22 years old. Okay, I bought my first piece. I was at Ohio State. My tuition was $150. And I spent $125 for art. And everybody thought I was just crazy. And I thought I was crazy, too, because, like, who buys art at 22, right? So I understood the feeling that people would have, the reservations about spending, because I had it myself. And oftentimes, I would just take art to people's homes. I would place it on their walls. I'll come back a month, 6 weeks later, and see if they liked anything. And they said, oh, I can't afford it. So I said, okay. I started taking it down. Then they start seeing the void. See, art changes your life, and you don't know that it has. You know, so you don't know that you've been living in this void with nothing on your walls, right?
So they couldn't imagine the space without it.
Yes. Yeah. Then they said, let's work this out. Let's see how we can work this out. So that's how it became, you know.
Every art collection is really a kind of personal statement. Mm-hmm. How do you bring people along to understanding what their own collections might mean to them?
A lot of people come and say, I don't know what I like. And I give you one example. I had someone that said that to me, and I said, okay, let me see your closet. So I went to their closet and saw the colors and the styles that they had. Then I came back a couple of weeks later and presented work. He said, oh, I like this. He said, how would you know I like that? Well, everyone has a taste. You haven't had the opportunity to articulate it in art. I'm always trying to educate where you expand your vision. I don't want to change it. Just expand it.
Hopefully, works of art aren't just a look, but also an idea.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Anthony Artis, when I went to see the exhibition drawn from your collection at the Flint Institute of Arts.
Thanks for going.
Oh, sure. Yeah. It's really wonderful.
Thank you.
I loved seeing the works by big name artists, but I was also so in love with work by artists that you helped me to discover. There's an etching there by a guy named Benny Andrews that just captures four kids on a dreamy summer afternoon kind of moment.
Yeah.
And there's a print by the Brooklyn artist who created the series Stop Telling Women to Smile, who I'd seen her work. I didn't even realize I knew who she was. But she did street art portraits of women sort of punching back against street harassment. Her name is Tatiana Fazlalizadeh.
Mm-hmm. Good job.
I practiced. What kind of moments of discovery do you get out of looking at art?
Oh, wow. For me, each of the pieces we have kind of has their own personal story. Like, it's one piece by Michael B. Platt, and it's a picture of two sisters. And one has their arm around the other sister. And they're both young girls, probably definitely under the age of 7 or 10. But when I first saw the piece, it reminded me of a picture of my mother and her twin sister when they were 4 years old. My mother's a twin, and my father, he's a twin. And
oh, wow.
So, yeah, so it's, my mother's name is Juanita Artis, and my aunt is Melita Mosley. And so in the picture, they both had a bow on their hairs, little white dresses, and they had an arm around each other. And so when I saw the title of the piece, Two Sisters, immediately, you know, it took me to that childhood photo of my mom and her twin. And so first time we ever shared our art publicly, that was a piece that they focused on in their marketing materials. And I realized, you know, we didn't want to do any kind of copyright infringement. And so they said, Anthony, you better get the permission from the artist. So I was able to contact Mr. Platt directly. And in talking, he said, well, are you going to use this? You know, how are you going to use this image? And I said, sir, I said, we're going to do a lecture to educate people on what you're doing and just share information. He said, man, well, where's this going to take place? And I said, well, Flint, Michigan, at Flint Public Library. He said, get out of here. He said, my wife is from Flint. She was born in Flint. He says, Carol, hey, baby, they're going to do something in Flint. We're going to help them. And so all of a sudden, he just, I mean, no reservation. He was all in. And then he says, listen, if you're ever on the East Coast, he says, I live not far from Howard University. Come on, check us out. Let me show you my studio. And I felt like I met a long lost friend. And so 2 years later, David and I had the privilege of going to the East Coast to do some, to attend a collector's event at the Driscoll Center at the University of Maryland. And in going out there, we had the wonderful privilege of meeting Michael B. Platt and his wife, Carol A. Bean. She's a poet. But long story short, they had this big dinner for my wife, Davida, and I. They really loved on us and treated us with kindness. And we really were long lost friends. And sadly, he passed in 2019 of last year. And but every time now I see this piece, it, you know, started out reminding me of my mother. Now it reminds me of a wonderful man who had a wonderful gift.
If you're just joining us today, my guests are Reverend Anthony Artis. He's a collector who lives in the city of Flint, and George Anamdi, founder and owner of Anamdi Center for Contemporary Art in Detroit. The art world has been through so many seismic changes in the past decade. It used to be that galleries were all about building relationships with collectors. And there's no gallery that's going to turn you away when you walk in. But the people who run galleries now have to spend a significant portion of their year on the road, running around international art fairs. You know, Art Basel is the name that everybody knows, but also Art Basel Miami, the LA Art Fair, Frieze New York. And at the same time, it seems like the art world is turning to African-American artists, like all of a sudden, to, you know, to fix a lack of representation.
Yes.
George Anamdi, how have things changed for the way that you do business in this environment?
Well, it's changed. I think, one, people think about investment a lot more. When they always talk about investment in art, you know. Well, when I started, art was not an investment for me. I mean, I thought it may appreciate a little bit, but not like it has to today. And I always explain to people, because most of the time what you're buying is not really a serious investment. Just because you buy something from an artist doesn't mean it's going to really appreciate. But I do try to tell them, it's like, what you do, just buy what you like and just enjoy it. Your investment is having the experience of having it in your life, and it changes your life. It changes how you look at things. I had a abstract painting that I would come home to sometime and just look at, you know, and this float away in it, you know. So you have all these different kind of experiences. So it does change how you do things and how you see the world. We got to get back to buying it because you really like it. If you want to do a collection, try to have a direction with your collection. So your collection represents some type of theme or some type of style.
Artists exploring ideas in different ways.
You know, so like I have my collection is predominantly abstract.
Anthony, just in the time that your family has been collecting, have you noticed changes in what's going on and what's on the market and maybe sometimes who you're bidding against?
Yeah, I'm noticing when I first really woke up to it, right around 2009, we bought the Tanner piece. And I was made aware of Swan Galleries in New York. You know, they were the first ones to really have a specific African-American artist, you know, sale. And so I started out initially getting some of the catalogs and just getting familiar with the names. And so over time, you know, I would see some familiar pieces that were resurrected every few years, where now it just seems like, you know, they're starting to sell more. The values are just, you know, kind of mind-blowing. You know, I don't know if it's just trendy or people just waking up to it, but I'm starting to see a lot more people entering the game. I know Puff Daddy or P. Diddy bought the one Kerry James Marshall piece.
He's a serious collector.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, some of the people who let me know he bought it wasn't so much for his love, but really to make a mark saying I got the top, you know, piece at this value. And so, you know, people are in it for different reasons, but, you know, I'm in it because it really speaks to me, and certain artists' stories speak to me. Benny Andrews, the piece that we had at the exhibition was called Dreamer, and it shows a few kids laying on the beach, and they have a little afro. And when he was a child, you know, he just dreamed about being off the farmland in Plainview, Georgia, getting out the hot sun working. And ultimately, once he did get an education, travel the world via the Air Force, he saw a lot of dreams come true. But what really touches me about this man's story is the fact that he protested for a lot of New York galleries and for people to give people of color an opportunity to share and to show their works.
George Anamdi, if someone is the kind of person who Most of the art they see is maybe on Instagram, and they're just thinking about themselves entering this space as a collector. I heard what you said, that you'd advise people to go for the art that moves you. But is there any other advice you would have for people who are thinking about collecting African-American artists right now?
Well, I would say that not only that it moves you, but I think you also need to have an advisor. The dealer is not a middleman in art, okay? It's not like a wholesaler.
They're
not there. That's the market is really the dealer. And I always say that, you know, the educated person, you get much further with the dealer knowing what you're getting.
Why not buy direct from artists?
Well, one, if an artist sells a lot directly to the public, they're going to spend a lot of their time just selling. They will not be creating. Okay. And the artist, if you want to create value, you need someone else telling people this is great. Everybody come to your studio and you saying, I'm great. You don't want to hear that.
You need to be great.
Yeah, right. So a lot of times that's what happens. You know, the artists get caught up in just selling their own work and they don't go further.
George Anamdi, thank you so much for all your work over the years and for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
George Anamdi is the founder and owner of the Anamdi Center for Contemporary Art in Detroit. His gallery is going to be hosting a talk this Thursday with Dr. Charles Boyd, a surgeon who collects art. He's also a board member at the Detroit Institute of Arts. And we've also been talking with Reverend Anthony Artis. His family's collection is the basis of the exhibition on view now at the Flint Institute of Arts called Wonderfully Made. Thank you so much for being with us here and sharing some of your experiences.
Thank you.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. After a break, we gauge the flow of outside money in some of the most hotly contested election races in Michigan. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. This election season, the flow of ads in your Facebook feed and on your screens is increasing. Behind the scenes, money flowing to some of Michigan's contested races is increasing as well. Craig Mauger is a reporter for the Detroit News who's been writing about this. He's formerly the director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. Craig, good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
You published an in-depth piece last week about Senator Gary Peters' re-election campaign and some of the donations that are flowing in. The best-funded contender on the Republican primary ballot right now is John James. What did you find when you started looking into donations for his campaign?
We found that there was a group called Better Future Michigan Fund that had raised $800,000 from members of West Michigan's DeVos family. And you might question, why does that matter in this race between James and Gary Peters? And the reason is that in U.S. elections today, especially close competitive federal level elections, a lot of the spending takes place with outside groups. These are groups acting independently of these two campaigns. So this group, Better Future Michigan Fund, has had a stated objective of trying to help John James beat Gary Peters in 2020. And the fact that it's already gotten $800,000 from members of the DeVos family is a signal of how much activity this group might be undertaking this year.
What did you learn about how many donors this PAC has?
As of the end of 2019, that's all we have disclosures for so far, this PAC had 6 donors, all of them members of the DeVos family, and all of them giving between $100,000 and $200,000.
Is there much mobility in the super PACs that you've tracked? John James has had a pretty successful run for office before. Folks might remember he challenged Debbie Stabenow in the Senate race in 2018, and he didn't lose by very much. Can you tell if any of the donors that were active in his campaign at that point were active here?
Yeah, the DeVos family members had given some contributions, and through corporate entities, they'd given other contributions to super PACs one particularly the Outsider PAC that was active in the 2018 race. The contributions didn't total up to $800,000, however. This is much more than they gave last time around. And another difference is that in 2018, John James had to win a competitive primary election in order to get to the general election. So that delayed some of the large flow of money into his race, because donors often don't want to give until a candidate has been anointed by primary voters. In this case, with Gary Peters, John James is seen by many to be the heavy favorite to be the nominee, and that's allowed some of this early money to pour in already. There's been PAC spending by other groups backing John James, and it's allowed this race for the U.S. Senate to really get started a lot earlier.
Are family PACs a new thing?
No, this is not a new thing. I mean, we've had PACs around for many years that have raised money from a single family or been largely powered by a single family. In Michigan, the DeVos family funds a large number of PACs. I think what is somewhat new is the number of PACs that are being powered by individual donors. I mean, this is happening much more often in 2020 than it happened 10 years ago in 2010.
Craig, it's definitely a little bit weird to look at a campaign disclosure form and see six people with the same last name being stacked up there. But is there anything inherently troubling or problematic about how this works? I mean, isn't this sort of the same as how donations have happened in the pre-Citizens United era, when, you know, maybe one person was not in a position to give or didn't want to have their name appearing on campaign finance disclosure forms many times, so they would have a donation happen through a family member?
Yeah, I mean, I think people have been giving as family units for a long time. When you give to a candidate, there are limits on how much you can give directly to that candidate. So oftentimes, people will have family members give the maximum amount in addition to their own maximum amount as a way to pour as much money as possible into a candidate's campaign. What we have now is this independent spending element of it, where groups that are acting independently of the candidate's campaign can raise unlimited amounts of money. And with the DeVoses, they have done this for many years in terms of the family kind of giving as a unit on the same day in similar amounts to political action committees or candidates that they like.
How would you rate the transparency of independent spending in the wake of Citizens United?
In the wake of Citizens United, and before it in many ways, in Michigan, we've always had large sums of undisclosed spending by groups. Citizens United primarily affects groups that run ads telling you specifically how to vote. And it's a court ruling that says that corporate entities can give as much as they want and government cannot put limits on it as long as this is happening independently of the candidates. And that is spending, again, that tells you how to vote. In Michigan, for years upon years upon years, we've had this tradition of dark money spending that runs ads that don't tell you expressly how to vote. They either slam a candidate and say, hey, this person is awful, call them and tell them they're doing an awful job, or this person is great, call them and tell them that they're doing a great job. Citizens United doesn't specifically affect those groups because they're not considered in Michigan at the state level here to be election spending. They don't fall under campaign finance disclosures because there's kind of this difference. Citizens United did put a boost in terms of groups running corporately funded ads telling you how to vote. So that's where the growth area has been, dark money ads telling people how to vote.
Do you have any observations for us on how super PAC spending has worked out in the modern era, maybe from the 2016 or the 2018 contests?
Yeah, something that I talk about often when I was at the Michigan Campaign Finance Network that tracks all of this, we had in 2018 a number of very competitive U.S. House races in Michigan. We're thinking specifically here the 8th District race that saw Alyssa Slotkin flip a seat and the 11th District race that saw Haley Stevens flip a seat. And you can kind of see in these two races what's happening in competitive contests in this era of money in politics. In the 8th District race, Alyssa Slotkin won. That race drew $28 million. And of that $28 million, only $11 million flowed through the candidates' campaigns. So a majority of the money, $17 million, came from these outside groups that were acting outside of the candidates' campaigns. If you got mailers in that race, if you saw TV ads, a large number of them did not say paid for by the candidates at the bottom. It said paid for by Independence USA or America First Action. These were two of the super PACs that were heavily involved. Why does this matter? Well, the shift is candidates' campaigns have limits on how much they can raise from individual donors, and all of their donors must be disclosed, and they can't take money directly from corporations, while these outside spenders can receive unlimited amounts of money from individual donors, and they can take corporate money, and that's when it becomes harder to track where the money is coming from. So that's kind of the shift in money in politics that we're seeing right now.
Is this something that you expect to see continuing into the 2020 cycle, that more than half of the cash spent in contested races would come from the super PACs?
Yeah, if it is a competitive race, if it's a race where both sides are trying hard to win it, I would fully expect to see over half of the money in some of these, especially the U.S. House races, most likely this U.S. Senate race that we're about to see in 2020, over half of the money from all the data we've seen previously is likely to come from these outside groups that are acting outside of the candidates' campaigns.
You know, there were some concerns around the time of Citizens United that the outside spending was going to come from places that basically could not be directed or controlled. In theory, the outside groups aren't allowed to coordinate with the campaigns. And so, you know, there were some people who were involved in politics who said, this really isn't a good idea because it doesn't allow our candidates to communicate in the way that the campaign team agrees is a good thing, or in ways that are a positive impact on the race. How would you say that's played out?
That's a great question. I mean, I think there are candidates who are sometimes frustrated by what these outside groups are putting out there. But there's also this deniability that happens, where if there's an ad that is really nasty, that's really negative, and voters in general don't, they might respond to them, but they don't appreciate how negative some of the ads are. If a voter gets frustrated by an extremely negative ad and it comes to from an outside group, it's a lot harder for them to hold the candidate responsible, because there's this arm distance length between the candidate and the outside group that is supposedly independent of the candidate. So the outside group that likely most voters have never heard of is the one pumping in the most negative messages often into these races. So that's one dynamic that has definitely played out, is you've seen a lot of the negative ads that now air coming from these independent groups that are sometimes murky in who's running them or how they're connected to the candidate.
Craig, are there any other races within Michigan that you expect to see drawing a lot of outside spending this year?
So, I mean, it's possible in the 3rd Congressional District, which is Justin Amash's current seat, that there could be a very competitive race that draws outside spending. The 6th District, where Fred Upton is expected to run for re-election, could be a race where you see a lot of outside spending. And one of my colleagues and I in my office were just talking about, we have 2 seats on our Michigan Supreme Court that are going to be up for election this year. And Michigan is kind of notorious for having very expensive state Supreme Court races. And often in those races, a lot of the money flows in from dark money, untraceable groups. And it's very possible that we could have a large amount of outside spending in our state Supreme Court races this year as well.
Well, Craig, thank you so much for talking to us about this. And we really appreciate all your work. Looking forward to reading more of your stuff this year.
All right. Thank you so much for having me.
That's Craig Mauger of the Detroit News. If you listened to Stateside last Friday, you might have heard our conversation with Steve Muth from the town of Onstead in Lenawee County. Steve and his wife Jane, their adult daughter, and her boyfriend had been stuck on the cruise ship Westerdam for 2 weeks due to fears of the new coronavirus outbreak. When we spoke on Friday, the ship had finally made port in Cambodia. Steve and his family were relieved and expecting to be back in Michigan this weekend. Yeah, that didn't happen. Joining me now from Cambodia is Steve Muth. Steve, what in the world is going on?
April, it's not done till it's done. I'm afraid to say, we thought we had crossed the finish line, and with all of 2% left, we didn't get there. So What happened was we started the process of taking flights home, boarding a charter aircraft in Shankville, the port town here in Cambodia, landing in Phnom Penh. By the way, we got a very nice reception, 10 generals from the army there greeting us, very nice, bowing in a very positive way in terms of greeting us with a very warm, heartfelt kind of response, only to go into the main ticketing area and find out that our flight was not leaving. Initially told it was delayed, but realistically what happened was there was an 83-year-old American woman, supposedly, that fell ill in Kuala Lumpur, and that stopped everything. Nobody was going anywhere from that Westerdam flight, unfortunately. So they basically diverted us to a hotel here in Phnom Penh, and here we sat for the last 3 days wondering what our future looks like. We did testing yesterday. And by that, I mean actual testing for the virus, which is not pretty. It involves taking a 10-inch cotton Q-tip swab kind of a deal and sticking it into your nasal cavity to the point where it touches the bottom of your brain.
Oh.
Pull that. I know, it's not pleasant. I hope I didn't offend your listeners. But it's true. That's what they do. And then when you're done with that, if that doesn't affect you enough, then they go to your throat, the same level, another 10 inches all the way to the back of your throat. I've got, by the way, a pretty strong gag reflex, and I had to cackle a number of times before they got that out of me. 400-plus were tested, apparently all negative. We had a meeting today with the CEO and a cocktail reception at 6 o'clock. It looks like everybody came back negative, which is great, but we still don't yet have approvals for flying out.
What are you being told right now about, you know, is there at least a game plan in place for what happens with the next round of testing, or how long you'd have to test negative to be allowed to leave?
So that's a great question. And my question to the authorities is, why, you know, none of this makes sense, because here's the deal. Why does Cambodia care if we have illness or not? If we get on a plane to the U.S., that affects Cambodia in no way whatsoever, right? And so we keep hearing the State Department, embassy people saying one thing that just doesn't make sense. That's been a constant disappointment and frustration, because they keep saying things that just don't seem to really make sense to anybody. A lot of Americans are very frustrated with this.
Has the State Department been responsive to your request for information or for help?
No. And by that, I mean, I've had interactions with them, frustration with them. The ambassador, by the way, is absent, AWOL. Haven't seen him at all throughout this whole crisis. Look, I don't know what they got going in the country of Cambodia, but I can't think of anything more important than 600-plus Americans looking to get home. He has not been here at all. And I asked a staff member today, and I got no answer. So as to where he is and why he's not here, just a lot of frustration, quite honestly. And not a good, you know, it's just been a negative experience with those people from A to Z. The cruise line, great deal. They've been outstanding. The people of Cambodia, thumbs up. Just all over, very, very good. Our own State Department, thumbs down. Not good. At almost every level. They've not been offering really any valuable service or information at all. They might give you a bottle of water, but, you know, don't expect any help from the U.S. government if you, you know, come to a place like Cambodia. And I'm disappointed to say that, but it's true on so many levels. And to be honest, when I ask them questions, they give me an aggressive, negative response. Why is it we can't do this? Why, you know, why is it, for example, that Americans can't fly out of, you know, certain areas or different airports? They can't answer that for me. They say that, you know, you might not get through. Well, why is that? How do they know that we're from the Westerdam or that there's issues here? No answer.
What's the mood been like among the passengers? Is it safe to say the level of impatience is growing?
I would say so. And again, it's because of the State Department. We had a meeting today with the CEO of Holland America, and that was great. But when it comes to the State Department and the embassy, huge frustrations. People don't trust them at this point. They don't give consistent information. So, you know, if we get out of here, it's not going to be because of their help.
What is your best guess at this point about when your family might be able to be home?
2 days. We hopefully will be on a plane in 2 days. Tomorrow would be great. It's possible, but it's probably less than 10% in my view.
Do you feel at all nervous about your own health?
I don't. Yeah, I mean, based on what I'm seeing with the people that we're with, I don't feel that level of insecurity.
Well, Steve, we're pulling for you, and good luck. We hope you guys are able to hang in there for a couple more days, and hopefully it's not any longer than that.
Let's hope so. We're looking to get home to Michigan. Absolutely.
Steve Muth of Onsted, thanks very much for checking in.
Thank you, April. Have a great day.
Tomorrow on Stateside, Joe Pera's videos on Adult Swim present a comedic version of himself as a middle school choir teacher living in Marquette. His gentle, goofy style has made his show, Joe Pera Talks With You, an unexpected hit.
It's hard to communicate the tone, and, you know, it's also a very personal show in a way. Everything on the show, especially the past season, was about personal stuff.
We're talking to Joe Pera on the next Stateside. We can't wait, and we know you're going to love it, too. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Peg Watson. Our producers are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Laura Weber-Davis. Our interns are Nell Ovitt and Olivia Scott. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll catch up with you tomorrow.